Night on Arena. Writer Declan Lawn and actor Joanne Crawford on season 2 of Blue Lights, and a new book on the cult classic that is The Blues Brothers. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Blue Lights is a hit Northern Irish police drama on BBC One. The first season of the show was so successful that it was recommissioned not only for a second season, but for a third and fourth one too. Season one followed three rookie police officers working alongside more experienced mentors in modern day Belfast, a city where frontline response police come under unique pressures and dangers. The second season of the show will be starting on BBC One on Monday the 15th next. And by the way, all of season one is currently available on the RTE player if you didn't get a chance to see it. I'm delighted to be joined on the phone this evening by series creator Declan Lawn and actor Joanne Crawford, who was Sergeant Helen McNally but is now Inspector Helen McNally. So I better watch my P's and Q's around her this evening. I suppose promotion for Helen McNally is one thing, Joanne, but promotion and continuation into season two and three and four, potentially. Who knows what way the story will go for your character. But that must have been a total and absolute delight for you.
Oh, I mean, beyond delight. I mean, the first series was such a joy. Hello, by the way. Good evening.
How are you?
Not too bad. The first season was just, it was a joy to just go to work every day. And it felt very much like, you know, we were all turning up and making this thing that we all loved on the quiet, with a lot of heart and a lot of intelligence. And we had no idea how it would be received, you know, in lots of levels. So to get the support to make season two and three and four was like... nobody had thought that was going to happen at all.
Yeah, manna from heaven. Manna from heaven, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. We feel very spoiled.
And for you, Declan Lawn, coming from the background that you come from, Declan, which is a journalistic background, it's perhaps not surprising that you should take something that has such a factual base, I suppose, in some ways within it, but it's a fictionalized version of that. What was the big attraction for the journalistic you to go over into the world of fiction where you didn't have to fact check everything 3 million times?
Well, that's a really good question, and good evening also. So Adam Patterson is the person who I write with, and I was a journalist in Northern Ireland for 16 years, him for about 10. And during all those years covering all of those stories, there were all of these ideas, kind of maybe you could call them philosophical ideas and considerations about a post-conflict society that we had and that we talked to each other about. But the journalism wasn't really the conduit to explore. And so this series and fiction gives us a chance to do exactly that. You know, ideas like the weight of the past and how the past affects the present. Socially and but also individually, things like idealism versus pragmatism, these kind of things that seem a little bit, you know, abstract, a bit nebulous, but that really fascinated us. So when you're writing fiction, you have got a canvas and you can explore all of that to your heart's content. So it's quite different from journalism in that way.
Yeah, we'll come back to you. We're going to try to get you on a better line there just for a second, Declan. But I'll come back to you, Joanne, on the character of Helen McNally. Again, I know the delights of the upcoming seasons are one thing, but when you read the character of Helen as you did in the scripts for season one, I'm wondering what your own reaction to that was, given what Declan is just talking about there. This is a very real Northern Ireland. The troubles are there for sure, but essentially this is about a group of people working together with a particular set of circumstances around them. But in some ways, it could be anywhere.
In some ways, it definitely could. And, you know, Declan and I and a few others have talked, you know, in passing about the idea when dramas are made very truthfully and specific to a location... there's an odd thing happens. They become very universal, and I think there's been loads of examples where we have seen that. You know, Happy Valley, Derry Girls would be two that come to mind. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of The Wire, dramas where people, where the writers go, we want to tell the story of this place. And in the truth of the specificity of that, people universally will respond. You know, it's quite a curious thing. And I think because Declan and Adam grew up here and live here, what they were able to bring to the writing was that specificity, having lived here. So that was, from what I can see, that's the heart side of it. And then their journalism experience, their journalistic experience, brought that rigor and that discipline of, you know, as they said, everything that you see in the series, you know, some of it did happen to some police officers. And then the rule they always go by is it could happen. You know, it may not be that this person and that person came together in the past, but these are all stories that are firmly bedded in truth.
And plausibility, plausibility is there all the time. Let's listen to a scene from very early on in the first episode, in fact, of season two, where yourself, Joanne, as inspector, as she is now, Helen McNally, you're in a meeting discussing the latest crime stats with Chief Superintendent Nicola Robinson, played by Andrea Irvine. And there's a new kid on the block here from the wonderfully named PCTF. That's the Paramilitary Crime Task Force. D.S. Murray Canning is the voice you will hear towards the end of this clip, played by Desmond Eastwood. But first of all, Joanne Crawford and Andrea Irvine discussing the crime stats.
Those are the latest crime stats for the district. Out tomorrow.
Right.
Not pretty.
No.
What's going on, Helen?
You know, I lost another response officer last week. That's the third this year. He left to become a lorry driver. Apparently the money is better.
I'm not interested in excuses, Inspector.
It's not an excuse, ma'am. It's a fact. Fewer cops, more crime.
Which is why you're getting a new response officer today. Constable Sheehan Bradley, transfer. D.S. Canning personally recommended him.
Is that right? So why are the PCTF interested in crime stats? I didn't think that was your thing.
The drug supply to the city centre has increased exponentially over the last year. That's the main reason for the rise in street crime and overdoses. If we can work out where the supply is coming from, we can cut it off and put a serious dent in those numbers.
From now on, D.S. Canning will be working closely with your section.
In what way?
In whatever way he sees fit.
Oh, I don't think she likes that. That is Desmond Eastwood as D.S. Murray Canning from the Paramilitary Crime Task Force. And we heard Joanne Crawford as Inspector Helen McNally and Andrea Irvine as Chief Superintendent Nicola Robinson. Season 2 of Blue Lights is what we're speaking about this evening with Joanne Crawford and writer Declan Lawn. I suppose in some ways, Declan, the other thing that you get to do, we have that soundbite. If it were a politician saying it, we'd say that's a soundbite for your cop. More crime, although would the politician admit to that? I'm not sure. But it gives you a chance in the fictional world to flesh that out from being a soundbite into a real drama and a real dilemma that affects the people that we get to know and love in this group of police officers.
Yes, precisely that. I mean, there's a confluence here between journalism and real life and drama, and we can take issues like that soundbite and really dig into them. The other thing you heard there was Helen saying, I lost two response officers who left to become lorry drivers. Well, that, you know, that came straight from the mouth of a police officer who I was talking to, who said we lost a police officer last year who left to become a lorry driver because the money was better. So it's a funny thing writing this drama because in a sense I come at it obviously as a dramatist. It has to be entertaining, first of all. But there's still a real journalistic strain to it where we can really dig into issues that are current and that are happening now. And that's just a very interesting space for me to be in, I think.
And how much does the post-Troubles aspect of the story feed into what you're writing about? Because it's contemporary Northern Ireland and we are thankfully in a post-Troubles situation. How has that fed into the stories that you're telling?
Well, fundamentally, because Northern Ireland is post-Troubles and post-conflict, but there's still a transgenerational trauma that is handed down
over the decades to people who didn't live through the Troubles are still scarred by sectarianism and division, and yes, it's getting better. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we look here at the weight of the past and how it informs the present and the consequences of the violence that we endured here for 30 years. And it's very palpable in Blue Lights, and that's because I think it's still very palpable in the north of Ireland and in Belfast. And so if we were to write a show that ignored it, it wouldn't be real and it wouldn't be true. But it's very important to me that I think Blue Lights is a very hopeful and optimistic show. And it's about getting past that trauma, not wallowing in it.
Yeah, and it is that hope and that optimism is there for sure, certainly in the episodes that I've been watching. There are two aspects to it that really struck me. A kind of an emotional depth and punch that I didn't expect to get in some ways, and also a huge sense of humour. Let me talk to you, Joanne, about the emotional depth of the characters here, because Helen McNally, Sergeant as she was in season one, she was really... It's unfair to say mother hen, but she certainly knew how to look after the young recruits and how to kind of get them started. She's toughened up a little bit, has she, in season two, in terms of, now, you're out of junior infants now, lads. Get on with it.
Yeah, and I think, we've also used the phrase mother hen. In season one, she is responsible for making sure that these recruits come through. And for her, the primary word for her was all of her all of the staff that she works with is safety. So, you know, she, when we were talking about the idealism and the pragmatism, she's very much an idealist. She does not want to ignore the day-to-day life and the reality of the constables on the ground, even though she's being pulled through the ranks. You know, she went to from constable to sergeant, now she's inspector. So she does have a tough exterior, but I hope, I like to think that her motives come from a good place. You know, she is trying to, you know, make sure that this service is provided for, and these people are looked after, and that they're safe as they can possibly when they go out. And some of that is to do, you know, with the arguments about resourcing and some of the conversations that continue to happen between myself and Andrew's character and Desi's character, where we have different approaches to solving the ongoing problem that comes up in season two.
Yeah, and the Desi that you're talking about there is the guy from the P. I just love the fact that he's this PCTF, those several lettered names. I could see a real conflict starting to develop between the two of you and your attitudes, the two characters, that is. But there also is a great family feeling to this station that they're all, and it's now a much bigger station. But there's a great sense of that, which I presume, given starting out season one, nobody knew the success it was going to be. That must have been very much there on the set between all of the actors, I'm guessing.
Oh, absolutely. It was such a joy making season one. There was something quite curious about the pattern in which we were filming, because, you know, you would get paired in a car with somebody. And so you'd spend a couple of days with that person filming stuff, and you'd get to know that actor. And you weren't privy to what the other storylines were. And then you'd get paired with another actor in another scene and everything would continue on around you. So we loved getting to know each other. We were all really intrigued to get to work with each other as well. And then, of course, when we went to watch it, I got to watch it as a viewer, apart from, you know, your own face pops up and you kind of go, the percentage that you are not privy to.
Yeah, you saw what was going on. You saw what was going on in the other cars, I suppose, that your characters weren't in. And I suppose that partnership element of police officers is quite important within all of this, Declan. And the other thing that struck me is, of course, how could you have a series set in Northern Ireland that didn't mention the specifics of Northern Irish food, which seemed to play a big part. I'm thinking particularly of the relationship between the character of Grace, who's this, I suppose she's a woman played by Sian Brooke, who comes to the the police force later on. She was a social worker. And there's something going on between herself and Martin McCann's character that we kind of get a sense of. What is a humble 15 that they're eating in season two, episode one? And when can I have one? When can I taste it, please?
So a 15 is a Northern Irish tray bake, which is made of digestives, cherries and marshmallows and condensed milk, right? And I was actually amazed that people outside of Northern Ireland had never heard of it after I wrote that piece. So, yeah, basically the food in it is a bit of a love language between Stevie and Grace. So it's kind of, it's their way of saying to each other, I fancy you, but I'm not actually going to say this. I'm just going to make you something really nice to eat. And it was drawn, again, from real life, from a real cop I met who decided that one way to keep morale up within the section would be if he came in with lovely food every day. And so we just took that from real life and we built it. And it seems to have really resonated with people. But the good thing about it is it means that we get lovely food on set. So when the actors have finished their scene, we all just eat the stuff that's left over.
Oh, yeah. I wondered were there ongoing competitions between the cast and crew in that respect, Joanne, who could bake the best humble 15? Or indeed, later on, we get pork pies with chili jam. Between Martin McCann's character and Sian's character, I mean, it's so Ulster, really, isn't it? That kind of focus on food, yeah. I think.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're not really talented in the baking department. The competition would be more with who can get to them first and quickest, as opposed to us having to be responsible for making them.
Oh, yeah. So those were the scenes that people said, can I just have another take on that? I don't feel like I quite got it. Can we refill?
Yeah, I'll just hang around set for this one.
it gives us a sense of that humour. And it's always there, Declan. I suppose this is coming from both yourself and Adam Patterson. And the fact that you're both from that neck of the woods, you seem to have got that balance that often you get in Ulster people where, yeah, they're laughing at things, but sometimes they're laughing at things because they can't face them. There's a very interesting line that I picked out of episode one. Even after all these years, people think the truth is still dangerous. I might have added in a still there, but it kind of gives the sense of it. You're not running away from the truth, but it must be hard because you put all the communities up under the spotlight here, and you put the drug dealing and the ex-paramilitaries up under the spotlight here. How dangerous did you feel it was to do that, or was it just you'd no choice but to do it?
I don't really feel it's dangerous, but I feel a massive, sometimes overwhelming sense of responsibility to get it right. So in the scene you're talking about, it's about a legacy case that happened decades ago. And so in order to research that, myself and the two actors involved went to the Wave Trauma Centre in North Belfast, where victims of the Troubles, victims and survivors, convene every day and talk and have therapy. And we spent a lot of time with them. And so that's the extent that we go to try and get it right. But, you know, the honest to God truth is I feel sometimes a really oppressive sense of responsibility to tell a story about my own place and my own time with all of these controversial issues. It feels like walking a tightrope sometimes, but it's something that I feel it's important to do. And I'm just going to keep trying to do it as best I can and hope that the effort we put into it justifies telling these stories. Mm.
I don't want to spoil things on in season terms of season one, because people will down here will still be watching it potentially on the RT player and may not be aware. But let me just say that a major character comes to their demise at the end of season one, which is a huge kind of hangover throughout season two. Are you heading down the Game of Thrones? It seems to be a Northern Irish thing again, the Game of Thrones route. No character is safe. No character need presume just because there are four seasons that they're in four seasons.
this is where the 15s come in, where we bribe the writers and go there.
Please don't. Really, that is the thing. Every time anyone talks to me about the show when I'm out and about, that's the one thing they talk about is that death. And they all love that character so much that all they want to say is, why did you do it? And the reason we did it is because it's a show about the consequences of violence. And to really explore that, you have to have something horrible happen, because really that death is a metaphor for the thousands of deaths that happened here over decades and all of the good people who were killed. And yes, you're very right, correct to bring up the word grief, because series two, he's not forgotten. And it really, series two in some ways is a study of long-term grief and what it, you know, what it does to you in good ways and bad. So yeah, I mean, it was a really crucial thing, that death, and I feel it was a very important thing to happen, but I really do never hear the end of it. every time I'm out, someone says, why did you do that? I hate you. And I go, okay, I'm really sorry. And
well, they need to watch season two and they'll find out why you did it, because the payoff comes out.
Exactly.
And Joanne, long may you continue to be tasting the humble 15s and whatever other food delights come your way. Thanks to both of you for being with me this evening. That's Declan Lawn, co-creator of the Northern Irish police drama Blue Lights, and Joanne Crawford, who stars in the series. Season 2 will be available, or will be out, on BBC One on Monday the 15th, that's next week. All of Season 1 is currently available on the RTE player, and we will be reviewing Season 2 in RTV Reviews next week here on Arena. And we stay with the Northern Irish Troubles in some ways for our next item, because in the midst of the political upheaval and social turbulence that was the Northern Irish Troubles, the lens of Japanese photographer Akihiko Okumura captured a different narrative of Northern Ireland. Photo Museum's latest exhibition is called The Memories of Others. It delves into the world of Okumura's photography. The work presents the first solo exhibition, a photo book and a documentary film on Okumura's Irish work. It sheds light on his distinctive approach to documenting conflict, his personal connection to Ireland and the impact of his rediscovered archive. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Pauline Vermaer, editor of the photo book and director of the documentary, and on the line from Berlin by Kusi Okumura, daughter of the late Akihiko Okumura. Let me go straight to you, Kusi, with that title of it, the wonderful essay that you've written as part of this whole series of events, How to Find a Ghost. It's a very interesting title. Tell us about why you had to go searching for a ghost in the first place.
Well, hi there. Hi, Sean. Well, basically because he wasn't around that much when I was growing up. He was always traveling. And then he died when I was 9. So I felt like I've always kind of been looking for him. Mm. And this exhibition was just a wonderful opportunity for me. It's a real personal journey to connect with him and his memory. And so hence the title of the essay.
And you grew up in Ireland, you grew up in Wicklow. Your father's choice that you should grow up in Ireland, he wanted to be here. Had you, what sense did you have of that, you know, maybe from other family, or maybe from your mother, or from your extended family, of his desire for you to grow up in this part of the world?
Well, I don't know if I felt any kind of outside force or anything, but we were just Irish. That's just the way we were. And my mother would mention it sometimes because it is, you know, we're first generation, and she'd say, "Oh, you're so Irish." But I do have a sense that he wanted us to be Irish. Yeah. He did. He wanted us to be Irish, and we spoke English at home, and Irish, and he loved Ireland.
Yeah,
Ireland.
And that is clear in the photographs in a peculiar type of way, I think. And let me turn to you on that particular aspect of things, Pauline Vermaer. You had to find this ghost as well, but maybe you had a more objective search in that you could approach it as an historian, as an artist, as a lover of photography. What is it about Okumura's photographs, particularly the Northern Irish photographs? What is it that singles him out from other people?
There were a few elements that really struck me as a historian looking into the representation of the conflict. That was my PhD was about the representation of the Troubles in 69. And I had been looking at a lot of work. A lot of it was in black and white. Gilles Perez, Don McCullin, many others, Northern Irish photographers as well. When I first saw the work of Okumura, I was working at ICP in New York as a curator, and somebody handed me a catalogue of a Japanese photographer whose show had been exhibited in Tokyo. And on the cover of it, I see what I think is Belfast during the Troubles. And so I inquire, was a Japanese man? I grew up in Japan, I should say, which is also so. But so I was not expecting to see a Japanese photographer, you know, having worked in Ireland. And so I started investigating. It was really a proper investigation, which is how I was incredibly lucky to find Kusi. By complete chance, I mean, looking through the internet, I was very lucky to be working during those days where you can find people. Because what was very interesting for me, of course, was the work. The work is stunning. It's in color. It is incredibly painterly, poetic. So it's a political work, but you could feel, I could sense there was something else behind this work, right? It was not quite photojournalism, even though he started as a war photographer. This Irish work that he did was different, even from his own work in Vietnam. It was different.
Because he previously had been a war photographer in Vietnam.
He had.
With, where the photographs are incredibly explicit. There were, I think there was some controversy over some of the photographs of dead soldiers that were published in newspapers. Mm-hmm. It was a very specific type of war photography that we got in that earlier manifestation.
Yes, and very successful, right? He was published in Life magazine. They called him kind of a new Robert Capa, who's a photographer who influenced him greatly. But in Ireland, something happened for him. You could sense personally, you could sense that. And so for me as a historian, even as a historian, I had to understand what personally had happened for him to understand what was underneath the beauty of this photograph. It's not just the beauty. There's something clearly almost mystical, if I may, when you look at the work. And I hope many people will feel this when they come and see the show at Photo Museum Ireland. There is something deep there, existential, that is really fascinating.
Let's listen to a clip from the documentary at this point. And this is Tom Burke. He's talking about the photographs here, and he's talking about the importance of colour. We'll also hear, I think it's Trish Lamb in the midst of this clip as well.
An awful lot of the material that focuses on the Troubles is in black and white. And it prioritises things that are quite dramatic and quite easily understood because it was destined for print, for newspapers. What O'Camera was able to do at those same events was stand back. So there's a context in a lot of his work that's missing from the work that I'd seen before.
There's a great image of children stuffing an effigy. And they're just, the colour is gorgeous in them. And it's his vantage point and the fact that the kids aren't paying attention, they're not performing to the camera. It's those kind of images, I think, that are really kind of surprising.
The thing that jumped out at me was fire. The fire has colour. The fire has presence. The fire has warmth. And indeed, in having presence and warmth, it has extra danger. It sounds very naive to say so, but black and white imagery of fire, I suppose I was looking at them slightly more dispassionately. But when you see the vivid and immediate colour of the fire, it becomes more striking.
And that is, yes, indeed, Tom Burke and Trish Lamb from Photo Museum Ireland in the midst of that clip from the documentary, the film, the whole, it's a whole project, really, that we're speaking about this evening with Pauline Vermaer, curator of that, and Kusi Okamura, the daughter of the photographer we just heard being described in that clip by Tom Burke. I was talking to you before we came to air, Pauline, about that moment in Kenneth Branagh's film Belfast, which actually starts in colour and then reverts to black and white for that period. There is something extraordinary about seeing images of the time in colour, because we're so used to seeing newspaper images which were black and white. And even in the early part of the Troubles, colour television wasn't common around the entire island at that stage.
Yes, and I think that the colour is part of why someone like Sean O'Hagan, who is also part of the curatorial team for this project, or writer Robert McLean Wilson, who grew up in Belfast, these photographs seem to provoke a visceral reaction in people who actually experienced the Troubles, who lived in Belfast or Derry or other places in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. Those photographs seem to really make them feel like what they felt at the time, which is something that is quite unique, really, when you think of the imagery of the times. It's something almost personal, which is interesting when you think of the fact that the Japanese man, meaning someone who came from quite far away, took those photographs that are deeply personal to them.
Yeah, and that is an extraordinary aspect of your father's work, Kusi, the fact that he did come from a totally different culture into this Irish culture. And he was living in Wicklow, but travelling obviously up and down to Northern Ireland on a regular basis to capture these photographs. I have a sense of him. Obviously, I didn't know the man at all, but I have a sense of him in all of the photographs, even though he's never visible. Clearly, he's behind the camera. Do you have a sense of his presence, this ghostly presence in those photographs?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just an intimacy that is in his Irish photographs that I hadn't really felt. I had seen his photographs, of course, in photo books and particularly his Vietnam work and his other war photography. But there's an intimacy with his Irish photographs, which has made it different for me. It's made it able for me to connect with him. And because I think he really loved Ireland. Mm. He had this personal relationship with Ireland. And I think that really comes through in this collection.
I'm just looking at one of the photographs here just to describe it. This is Fountain Street in Derry. And it's a picture taken where there's a man standing on the corner of the street beside a no entry sign. And he's standing there reading the newspaper. But what you get there is we know this is Northern Ireland. We know that it's a period of incredible conflict. But there's a wonderful calmness, stillness and ordinary life goes on quality to this particular photograph.
Yes. And I think that's what really strikes us when we look at his work is the peaceful nature of those photographs and how there's a French writer who's Georges Perec who's talking about the infraordinary. And there's something about that normal, that eerie sense of normalcy, right, during a time of conflict. And that's what he was kind of looking for. Because if you look closer at this photograph, in fact, today Trish and I were looking at it closely, you see the coat of the man and you realize this is a policeman, right? He hung his, which is a lovely relation. By the way, the segment before us was so beautifully tied with this one. But so this is a Northern Irish policeman hang his hat and his coat on the
other lamppost,
yes,
on the other side of the street.
So you have to look into that. You can spend a lot of time with this photograph and there are layers and all of these photographs have so many layers.
There's another photograph that struck me. Was there a particular photograph from those Irish ones before I talk about the one I loved, Cusi, that stood out for you, that said something in particular to you?
I think there's the one of the two older women on the train and they're having this intimate conversation and they just are completely oblivious to him. But I don't know, it's not in a voyeuristic way, but there's something very tender about how he holds that moment. And I know that it's been mentioned quite a lot, but there is a poetry to his work. And he doesn't hand you the message. You have to sit with the work. And there's something lovely about that just everyday moment and how it's captured and the expression on these two women's face. You just can imagine the conversation. It's lovely.
Yeah, there is. You really, he seemed to capture characters. And it's a real skill of a photographer to do that in a way that, as Cusi said, it isn't voyeuristic. How has he managed that? How has he even got himself into the position where he can just snap that shot and it's a real moment in time. We really feel we're in the carriage with them.
I think he has the same talent as Henri Cartier-Bresson had, the French photographer, who is to make himself invisible. Some photographers wanted that for themselves, right? They did not want to be seen. Cartier-Bresson was one. Mm. And I think Okamura had that too. I think he really did not want to be seen. He managed to be discreet and to be trusted, you know. He was present. People knew he was there. Some of them you can see in the photos. They see him. They look at him. But nobody remembers him to the point that you think, was he even there? Which is the beauty of this project in general, is to see how present he was and how discreetly he took all those photographs.
There are two other photographs that really stood out for me, one of which, the three now in my head, but let me talk about the one that's captured of a soldier. I think this is in Bombay Street, is in Belfast, at the point at which the Catholic community, it's the subject of the film Belfast opens at this point in time as well, where the Catholic community were burned out of their houses effectively. And we see a soldier carrying a front door of a house with a woman walking alongside him. Again, an extraordinary moment to capture.
It is extraordinary. And Sean O'Hagan talks about this photograph beautifully when he talks about this. There's a surrealism to this photograph. The motif on the door, there's a little bird. Why is this soldier carrying that door? But it is this woman probably wanted to save that door, right? The her house had been burned down, and she was this was something to keep. Mm. And it's one of the most this is a great example of what Okamura was doing in times of real hardship. I mean, this was one of the turning points, right, of the conflict, the moment of strong vulnerability is how Sean O'Hagan talks about this moment also for the community. And how peaceful that moment looks like, you know, this man protecting. And you, if you don't know the story, if you look at this photograph without knowing anything about the context of this image, it will stay with you, right? This is an image that stays with you.
And there's another one that it's of, again, it's of two women walking down a kind of an alleyway is what I is the picture I have in my head, carrying cups. And there's crockery on a pram or on a table in front of them. I can't remember the specifics of that. And a little packet of bird's custard in colour, it has to be said, in the red, yellow and blue of that particular brand of custard sitting on the table in front of them. All of this invisibility that is there, Kusi. How frustrating is that invisibility for you? Because you are in search, or it strikes me that you may well have been in search of this ghost of your father.
Yeah, I do you know, the invisibility of him in these photographs, there's something about it that says to me that he felt like that he was not an outsider, that he was inside. He belonged somehow in Ireland. And that for me is really beautiful as well. Even though I didn't really know him very well, but I'm sure he was very much a proud Japanese man as well. But there was something about Ireland that made him feel at home. And I think there's the way that he views the whole of the Troubles as well. It somehow, in a way, reminds me of someone who's looking at like a family fighting, or you know, there's a way he observes both sides. With this very, there's a tenderness he captures, like the beauty and the pain on both sides, which is lovely, I think.
Yeah, because I think it's probably safe to say there's a very strong socialist ethic and aspects to what your father was and what he did in those photographs. It seems to be it's all about the people, not what side they're on or what particular cause they believe in. It's very much about the people themselves and the hardship they had to endure.
Yeah, the humanity. I think he really captures a humanity, and I think it really speaks. I mean, I've talked about this with Pauline. It really speaks to our times now, you know, these kind of fractured times that we're living in, which is, and, you know, the sense that nowadays the rules are kind of a bit broken. And he kind of captured that as well in his photographs, and that makes it even more meaningful now to have this exhibition, I think.
Yeah, and while I love the title of your essay, Finding a Ghost, equally the memories of others is quite. Why did you choose that title, Pauline? Finally, for the actual exhibition itself,
because it was interesting to look at the way a Japanese man would look at the memories, the history of another country. And now we're looking at his memories as well, right? So it's this sort of the idea of the... And photography. I mean, photography is all about, of course, memory and history. And how do we today look at these photographs, the memories of others, right? Could be Sean O'Hagan's, could be others, you know. But how does photography help with that? And how did Okamura help the Irish North and South? How does a show like this help with establishing those memories and, you know, the past being present, what you were talking about earlier?
Yeah.
I think photography ultimately is about this. And I think this is a project that encapsulates this beautifully.
Well, thank you so much for coming in to us this evening. That's Pauline Vermaer and indeed Kusi Okamura. Thank you for joining us from Berlin this evening as well, Kusi.
Thank you.
The exhibition that we've been speaking about, a series of works, in fact, really, we could say we're talking about Akihiko Okamura, The Memories of Others. It's at Photo Museum Ireland in Dublin from the 11th of April through until the 6th of July. An accompanying book will be published by Atelier EXB and Prestel in September, and the documentary film, will that be available? Will that be getting a general release, or will that be available
to
watch?
It's in the show. You can see it in the show.
You can watch it if you go into the exhibition.
Yes, and it will be on the night of the opening on Thursday night, on the 11th, it will be projected on the square.
Okay, that is the documentary that's well worth giving you the background to this wonderful photographer. You can find out full details on photomuseumireland.ie. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. yes, if you want to watch what's happening in studio, you can do so on rte.ie/arena. That's the name of the programme. But it would be more interesting to watch what's happening in the production area, I have to admit. I was bouncing up and down in my chair. Pat Carty was dubiously and extraordinarily still.
Look, I haven't even got a word in edgeways and you're already slagging me off.
Right, well, let us, in case you didn't realise it, we're going to talk about the 1980 movie The Blues Brothers, starring John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, first appeared as a sketch on the US TV show Saturday Night Live. It then grew into a live musical review before the John Landis directed movie became one of the box office successes of that year, grossing more than $100 million. In a new book, The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv and the Making of an American Film Classic by Daniel Devise, the lives of the cult classic stars as well as its chaotic production are explored. Pat Carty has read it. He joins me now to talk about the book. And he watched the film, being the fine professional researcher that he is. He watched the film again last night, was it, Pat?
I did. I watched it last night, yeah.
And you're already complaining about it.
Well, no, that would have been the first time I've seen that film in a long time, you know. And I mean, as you said, it came out there in 1980. I would have been a bit young to see it the first time around. But I did see it in the 1980s. And, you know, towards the end of the 1980s, probably, and thought it was very good. But the reason I think now I thought it was very good is it turned me on to all this music.
Oh, right, yes, the music is a very popular. It is a ponderous comic monstrosity.
Yeah.
A $30 million wreck minus the laughs.
That was the
Los Angeles Times and, the Los Angeles Times, both of those quotes. And they weren't the only one who ripped the film apart at the time.
Well, that first one was the Washington Post, but Rolling Stone also piled in, Rolling Stone magazine, and accused them kind of, I don't think they use the word racism, but I mean that it was exploitation, really. You know,
yeah, so we had these two white comics.
These two white guys in the middle, and very famous guys in America at the time, as we'll talk about, I'm sure. But bringing in a lot of these acts that were down on their luck at the time. So you got to remember, if they were making this film in 1979, 1980, you're talking about the era of arena rock was starting. You know, Van Halen were in the charts that time. Disco was a big thing. And a lot of these acts that make this film, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, James Brown, were at their lowest ebb, really, in their career. They were, you know, back to playing small halls. And so this was a huge leg up for them. Because this was, you know, despite those reviews there and despite it shooting over budget, it was a massive hit.
Yeah, it also made the budget back.
Oh, in three or four times.
Yeah, three or four times.
That was a surprise for a lot of people. Yeah.
It was indeed. So this book is not just about the film itself.
No.
In many ways, I think you could argue this book is about the two men,
Dan Aykroyd
and John Belushi.
John Belushi, the two stars of the film. And even more so, you could argue that it's really a biography of John Belushi, really, because it starts and ends with him. It ends when John Belushi passes away, more or less. And
he died. What age was he?
He was only 33.
Yeah.
And very sad end. And it kind of winds up there. There's a small bit after, but it winds up there. And so it's a biography of him and, to a lesser extent, a biography of Dan Aykroyd. And so what you have is it's divided in, I suppose, two separate strands until they actually meet.
Yeah.
So Belushi starts off in Chicago, son of Albanian immigrants. His father was a failed restaurateur. He was a football star in school. He was such a straight-laced guy in school that he ratted out the quarterback for drinking beer. So if you can imagine that, compared to what he turned into himself.
Excess was the problem when it came to
Life. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's what got him in the end. But he was very straight-laced as a young man. And then, so DeVise tells us, he goes off to a theatre camp. And there actually is witnesses to him having his first beer. And it turned him into, apparently straight away, it turned him into some sort of Tasmanian devil figure. And for better or worse, he never looked back then.
And how different was, the start of John Belushi was so different from who he was later on. How different was Aykroyd from
that? Aykroyd grew up in Ottawa in Canada, and his father was quite a well-to-do civil servant. And Aykroyd, actually, in the book, that was one thing I didn't know. He had Tourette's when he was young. Tourette's syndrome, which made him the target of many bullies and was surely a strange thing for someone who ended up a performer to have. Obviously, he got over it. But he was a lot more straight-laced than Belushi. And when they met, they both got
and
into...
And he maintained that straight-laced
aspect.
Yeah,
but he was...
He was a kind of straight man, funny man.
Certainly compared to Belushi, yeah. And he was... I mean, there was still... You see some of the stuff he did for Saturday Night Live later on. Some strange things going on, maybe. And he was... I suppose it's kind of... I'm not comparing them, but there's a Lennon and McCartney thing going on there, because obviously Belushi dies young and is, for better or worse, immortalised. And Aykroyd has the unfortunate burden of getting old, like the rest of us, and you know, making films that weren't really good and becoming a kind of a, you know, a conservative figure, you know.
Yeah,
like family,
John,
made family films and all that kind of thing.
And John Belushi is, John, all the great films that he didn't make are the ones that people talk about.
You could argue that as well, because even the films he did make while he was alive, right, there's Animal House before this, which made him a huge star. He was already a big star because of Saturday Night Live, because they were in the initial cast of the first season of Saturday Night Live. And that had a huge impact in America, much less so here. I don't think it was shown here. But Animal House was the film, I think it was the second film. He had a minor part in something before, but the second film, Animal House, was very small budget. If nobody's seen it, it's a college comedy about a load of layabouts in college. It's very funny, actually. But that was a huge hit, and he was kind of the breakout star. It hasn't aged well now. I have seen that recently as well.
All right.
It wouldn't get made now.
So trilby hats, dark glasses, the black suits, the white shirts, etc. That was the kind of the look of the Blues Brothers, because they are brothers in this. Were they brothers in the it started as effectively a sketch in Saturday Night Live.
It started, Aykroyd was a music nut. They both were, but Aykroyd was the man who was into the blues and rhythm and blues. And he was a harmonica player. And when he was a younger man, in Canada, he'd sat in with people like Muddy Waters and played harmonica, which is pretty cool achievement.
Yeah,
well,
sitting in with Muddy Waters is
that's
already
pretty good,
impressive,
you know?
Yeah.
And so he had the band on Saturday Night Live. Paul Schaefer was an old friend who was the musical director, or one of the musical directors. And every so often, Aykroyd would sit in with them. And what they did is the Blues Brothers came out of, I think, one of the other musical directors suggested they do it together. Belushi, mad for attention, said, I want some of this as well. They got in. He had met a guy in, I think, filming Animal House, I think, who had kind of turned him on to a lot of this blues, and he took some of that identity from him. So they started off as a warm-up act for Saturday Night Live, you know, because it's a live show. And then eventually they persuaded Lorne Michaels, the producer and creator of the show, give us a go. And the first time they appeared in bee costumes. I mean honeybee, you know?
Yeah.
And because that was a sketch that was on the show. And then eventually they persuaded him, let us go on. First time they were on, they got the reaction straight away was like, is this a joke? Is this, you know, is this a real music thing? And then it kind of took off then after that.
And that's, I suppose, from there we got, at what point did it become a film? When did it become a screenplay and become a film?
Well, what happened was so Steve Martin used to appear on the show. And he was a huge star. He was like the Led Zeppelin.
And did he have the banjo with him at that
stage? I don't know if he... there's no recorded version of him playing banjo with the Blues Brothers, as far as I know. But he was playing seven nights in some big arena. It might have been the Hollywood Bowl, somewhere in Los Angeles. And he asked them to support them. And they were a huge hit. And they had this great band. They'd hired all the best musicians, Steve Cropper, Donald Duck Dunn. And they recorded an album from that show. That album sold a million. They were huge stars. All this. So, of course, Universal, when they went to them, Universal said, yeah, let's make a movie. Why not? And then Aykroyd had to go off and write a screenplay.
And how did they get people like Ray Charles, people like Aretha Franklin? I think Muddy Waters was supposed to be there, but he was sick or something at the time, or at least that's the story.
Yeah, B.B. King was approached as well. And B.B. King's manager said, no, he's too busy. B.B. King was maybe the one out of the whole lot of them who was still gigging so much. He was too busy. And later on, when he found this out, B.B. King was desolated. And DeVise, actually, his idea for the book came from his previous book was about B.B. King, so he'd asked that question. But to get these guys, it would have been easier that time than maybe now. Or, well, obviously, you can get into them now.
Yeah.
But, you know, because they were, as I said, they were down their luck. So to get them in, to be offered the part in a Hollywood movie, they went, yeah, sure.
But to what extent did the film then become these great songs, these great performers, the Ray Charles, the Aretha Franklin, the et cetera, just a way of knitting all of that together into a kind of a cinematic mess, perhaps?
Well, there would be my problem with it. There isn't, like, the script is wafer thin. There's no plot at all. Like, there's a thing about they're orphans. Or they were orphans. Mm. And then, so the bit at the start where he gets released from prison and then they have to go and visit the nun, the penguin, who hits them with the ruler and then say, look, we need taxes for this place or they're going to close it down. So the whole thing is they get the band back together to get the $5,000 to pay the taxes for this orphanage, you know. And the actually a strange bit of trivia there in that. Obviously, I know you, well, Sean, and you take L'Observatoire Roman, the Vatican newspaper, I'm sure you take it in your house. And This film has been voted a Catholic classic by the church because of this. It's one of the recommended ones in that newspaper, alongside Passion of the Christ and the Ten Commandments. That's a true story.
Okay, I will take you at your word for that. Because I want to finish up with a bit of Aretha.
Sure, yeah.
But before we go to that, do we get into the dark side of Bellucci? What sent him into the, you know, the addiction and the really, you know, the excesses of his life? And how does that come out? And where does Aykroyd sit in the midst of all of that?
Well, they're great friends. It's kind of the main thing in the book is it's a bromance between the two of them. You know, Bellucci has a wife who's his girlfriend and all this. But I think it's insecurity, a lot of this, and you know, wanting to be part of the scene and all this. And I mean, the ending, as I say, is very, it's a sad ending. And you wonder as well, if it was now, I think maybe someone would have took him aside and said, look, let's take 6 months here and go off to rehab and all that. But at the time, it's keep rolling. And there was movies after the Blues Brothers. He made one or two. Like he made 1941 with Spielberg, which is a disaster. Terrible movie. Mm-hmm. And then another one where they tried to give him, and that's Spencer Tracy, kind of romantic comedy role. Woeful, yeah. You know? Yeah. So, I mean, This is his big moment.
And the book tells good tales.
Yeah, I think I wrote a review about it, and I honestly do think I think the book might be better than the film, to be honest with you.
Oh, no, you could get
even though the film, as I say, the music, incredible, amazing.
Let us finish with the music then, and let us finish with Aretha.
Would it make you feel any better if you knew that what we're asking Matt here to do is a holy thing?
You see, we're on a mission from God.
Don't you blaspheme in here. Don't you blaspheme in here. Now, this is my man. This is my restaurant. And you two are going to just walk right out that door without your dry white toast, without your faux fried chickens, and without Matt Guitar Murphy.
Now, you listen to me. I love you, but I'm the man and you are the woman, and I'll make the decision concerning my life.
You better think about what you're saying. You better think about the consequences of your actions.
Oh, shut up, woman.
You better think.
Oh, I'm sorry, Aretha. I better think about fading it, but I do have to do that right now. That is Aretha Franklin from the Blues Brothers, the film, and Pat Carty speaking to us about the book, The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic, Daniel DeVise, published by White Rabbit. 15th of August, for those of you who are wondering, when does Blue Light Season 2 come to the television? 15th of April, beg your pardon, next Monday, 15th of April, next Monday, when does it come to the BBC? That is our lot for this evening. Niall Fitzmaurice and Leah Murphy Research. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme, produced by Sinead Egan.